Let's pick up where we left off in the book of Joshua. We left off in chapter 11. And, just to recap, when we went through chapter 10, remember that there was five different kings that went up against Joshua. I mean, there was the king of Jerusalem. His name was Adonai Zedek. And there was the king of Hezron, the king of Jarmuth, and the king of Lachish, and the king of Elgon. These five kings, they went up and they surrounded Gibeon to destroy it, because the people of Gibeon had made a pact with Joshua and the Israelites. Anyway, long story short, God delivered them up into their hands. But I think it's kind of significant that these five kings, when they didn't go up against Joshua, they ended up hiding themselves in a cave when they were put on the run by God's people. And that to me is very significant, because, like I said, a lot of times I think that people, even Christians, make a big mistake when they start reading the Old Testament, read a lot of things that happen, especially in the book of Joshua, when a lot of these people are just destroyed, the Canaanites. And people just can't grasp what God is trying to tell them, because we're told very clearly in Galatians 3, that all of Scripture is given to us for our instruction, for our reproof, for our edification, for our example. We're told that in Corinthians. We're also told that in Galatians 3 that, this is our tutor. This is our teacher. So we always got to ask, well, what is God trying to tell us? You see, this is the thing. God doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, the same today, he'll be the same tomorrow. And when you read about what happens to these people of Cana, you know, we got to put it in perspective and ask, well, why is God destroying these people? And it's because of their wickedness. But you see, nothing changes. A lot of times people say, well, you know, I don't believe in the God of the Old Testament. You know, he's just a God of thunder and ice. I believe in the God of the New Testament, where, you know, he portrays himself as being this loving and benevolent, merciful, kind, compassionate God. Well, these are all part of his attributes. All right, whether it's justice or whether it's compassion or whether it's mercy. But here's the thing. These five kings were locked up into this cave, and I think that's kind of significant, because nothing's changed, or nothing's going to change. Our history will, you know, just constantly repeats itself, because, you know, we read in the book of Revelation what's going to happen at the very end of the world. I think it's pretty darn significant, because if you read in Revelation chapter 6, verses 15, and the kings of the earth, the great and the men, and the commanders and the rich and the strong, and every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand it? And see, that's kind of significant. We read about those five kings who hid themselves in the cave, and then we're reading at the very end of the world what's going to happen. It says the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks and the mountains, you know, to hide themselves from God when he's returning with great power and great glory. As a matter of fact, Isaiah, the prophet, foretold that, and I think it's kind of significant what he said. I don't have time to read the whole passage, but what he said in Isaiah chapter 2, he said that, and their land has also been defiled with idols. They worship the works of their hands, that which their fingers have made. It says, so the common man has been humbled, and the man of importance has been abased, but do not forgive them. It says, enter the rocks and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And then he goes on to say, but the idols will completely vanish, and men will go into the caves of the rocks, into the holes of the ground, before the terror of the Lord, and before the splendor of his majesty, and when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they have made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. So stop regarding man, whose breath of life is in his nostrils. Why should he be esteemed? And I think that's kind of significant, because Isaiah wrote that like 750 years before the birth of Christ. He predicted what's going to happen at the very end of the world, that people, when they see Christ coming, they're going to hide themselves in the rocks and in the caves and in probably bomb shelters, anywhere they could try to find and hide themselves. And as a matter of fact, they're going to be crying out to the rocks and to the hills and to the mountains to fall on us and to hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne. So when we're reading about the judgments of these various kings, their time had come. Their cup of iniquity was overflowing, and God said, these people are going to be destroyed. because of their wickedness, because of their rebellion, because of their immorality, because of their sorcery, because of their witchcraft, because of their idolatry, all these things. So God doesn't change. We read about it in the Old Testament, we just read about it in the New Testament, we read about it in the book of Isaiah. So that's what I'm saying. When you read this, you got to stand back and look at the whole picture and say, what is God trying to teach us in this? Because I think that even though this is written centuries ago, even though this took place over 1,500 years ago, it's still very applicable to today. So when Joshua finishes this campaign, just kind of keep this in mind, just as kind of an overview. You know, when they first go into the Promised Land, it's kind of like a central campaign where he conquers this land in the center of Israel. Then he goes, and these five kings from the south, basically, are the ones that Joshua attacks when they attack Gibeon. Now, the kings of the north are going to come against Joshua. So you see, he's actually divided the land, and now divided and conquered as far as the enemies are concerned. That's where we pick up in this chapter 11 here, when it says, and it came about when Jabin, the king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, the king of Madon, and the king of Shimron, and the king of Asaph, and to the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and in the Arabah, and the south of Chinneroth, and in the lowland, and on the heights of Dor, on the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite at the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpeh. And they came out, they and all the armies with them, and as many people as the sands that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all these kings, having agreed to meet, came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. And the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of Israel, so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as the great Sidon and Mishrephoth Maim in the valley of Mizpeh to the east, and they struck them until no survivor was left to them. And Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him, and he hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Now look what's happened here. This King Jabin, he's the main king of the north. He gathers together all the kings that are in the north, you know, and they decide they're going to go up against Joshua. And this is what God does. I mean, he just delivers them into their hands. It's not like Joshua has to go fight each one of these kings individually. They just come against him like a great horde. I think it's kind of significant because here they have fought many battles by now. You know, they fought all the battles that were on the east side of the Jordan, and they won all that land, and now they fought all the kings in the battles both in central Israel and in southern Israel, and now they've got their biggest challenge where the greatest number of men are coming against them. And I think that's kind of significant because there is a spiritual significance to that, or a parallel to that, or application to that in this respect. I think that in our Christian walk, well, you've heard me say before, different level, different devil. It seems like the more spiritual we become, I think that the greater the challenge sometimes that will be presented against us. And here Joshua has been commanding his armies, the armies of God here, you know, during all these conflicts. And it's not getting easier, it's getting harder. But God says, hey, don't be afraid, don't be dismayed, don't worry, you know, be bold, be courageous, and stand up against them. And I think that that's what we have to do today. Even though we look all around us, and what are we seeing? I mean, we are losing the culture war in this society, this country. We virtually have lost it when it comes to standing up for, you know, the things of God, standing up for morality, standing up for truth, standing up for justice. We are really in a minority. I mean, if you stand up for God today, you are labeled as being hateful and bigoted and dangerous and fanatical. But again, you know, I think there's God's word is pretty clear. Hey, don't be dismayed. Don't be discouraged. Don't be afraid. Look at that verse 6. And the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. Now, of course, we're not in a literal fight with these forces that are constantly opposed to God. I mean, when I say a literal fight, I mean we're not using weapons of war. Okay, but it is a knockdown, drag-out spiritual conflict with these people who basically hate God and everything he stands for. And we are definitely losing this battle. But still, If Christians can just, you know, the ones who are still committed, if they can just show enough boldness and enough courage to stand firm, even in the face of the onslaughts of so much hatred towards God and the things of God, I'll give you an example. Stand up today. Stand up and just say, hey, evolution is a crock. Evolution is a bunch of baloney. It's just a bunch of bull. It's junk science that constantly is throwing in your face that, you know, all these different theories. All I'm saying is this. It takes courage to stand up and say that because you know you're going to be labeled as being a nincompoop. You're going to be labeled as being ignorant. You're going to be labeled as being stupid because you're not going along with the crowd that says we all came from apes. But you stand up and you say, hey, evolution's a crock, and they look at you like, well, what's wrong with you, man? This is science. It's not science. But you see, it means that you have to know what it is you profess to believe, know what it is you're talking about, stand up and confront these people, because everywhere we turn, what are we seeing? We're seeing the truth is being run into the ground. I mean, really run into the ground. There are so many cults. There are so many false religions. There's so many false teachers and false messiahs and false prophets that are running. They're coming out of the woodwork. And Jesus himself said, this will be one of the main signs to look for that will indicate his soon return, indicate the end of the world. He says, be on guard and be watchful because there will be many false teachers and this type of, well, that's what it takes, courage to stand up against this tide that's coming against us. And I think that's what God is saying to Joshua. What verse did we leave off here? Did anybody remember? The verse 10. It says, then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with a sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. Then they struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. Now, again, you read that, just anybody who just picks up the Bible and reads that, they're going to get totally, I think, erroneous conception of what this is all about. They're going to say, well, why did God have them do this? And this is another thing where people are always trying to put, let's say, for example, the Quran on the same level as the Bible, because they're saying, well, the Bible's full of violence, you know, as well as the Quran. But you've got to put everything in context, and you see what's happening here. God doesn't change. These people are under judgment. He's under severe judgment because of what? Because of their wickedness. And I'm looking at this country, and I'm saying, hey, I read stuff like this, and I cannot see how we can possibly escape the judgments that are coming upon. We can't. We just can't, because God doesn't change. He, you know, he's long-suffering, he's merciful, you know, he's patient. But just like with these people, their cup of iniquity began to overflow, so he just judged them. And he's doing the same thing with us in terms of trying to get our attention. But if we don't listen, we're going to be pretty well wiped out by the time it's over. He says here in that verse 12, he says, and Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds, except the Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. And all the spoils of these cities and the cattle and the sons of Israel took as their plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one to breathe. Now, again, you know, here's a situation where it may look like to the natural mind that these people were just doing this for spoil, but no, they were doing this as a judgment against a very wicked people. But then in the end, these people get all of these spoils. Well, you look at what's going to happen when Christ returns. What did Jesus say as far as the Beatitudes? He says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the kingdom of the earth. Inherit the earth, rather. It's like the people who are faithful to God, who are committed to God, who are living for God, these are ones who are in the end are going to inherit it all. Remember what Jesus had said? He said, what does a prophet man if he gained the whole world loses his own soul? Look what people are doing today to try to get ahead. I mean, it really is astounding when you look at how people are just scraping. I mean, I can hardly stomach to watch these commercials, these political commercials. Can you guys? I mean, it's just flinging one mud after another. You know, they're just dragging each other through the mud and clawing to get to the top. And I'm thinking, even if you get there, it's just 15 minutes of fame. You know, where are you spiritually? Because in the end, who's really going to rule this world? It's going to be the meek. It's going to be the people who are committed to God. They're the ones that are going to inherit it all. Jesus himself said, hey, seek first the kingdom of heaven and God's righteousness, and everything else will be added unto you. So when you read a verse like this, it has that spiritual application. He says here in that verse 15, it says that just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus Joshua took all that land, the hill country and all the Negev, all the land of Goshen and the lowland and Arabah and the hill country of Israel and its lowland, from Mount Halak that rises towards Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, and at the foot of the Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and put them to death. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. He took them all in battle, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle in order that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, that they might destroy them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron to Debir, from Abnab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. And there were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only Gaza and Gath and Ashdod, some remained. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the lands had rest from war. Now, he's kind of giving a brief summary here as far as what had happened. It just shows how he conquered these people that were, you know, just basically the sworn enemies of Israel. And he was given one victory after another. And then it says in that verse 22 that there was no Anakim left in the land. The Anakim, they had various names. Remember, they had the sons of Anak, or the Rephaim, or the Nephilim. These were all the names that were given to the giants of the land. They were referred to as giants because they were men of great stature. Remember, it says here that there were some of them that were left, the sons of Anak were left in Gaza and Gath. Remember, what were Gaza and Gath? What were they? Remember, what cities were they? There was five cities, Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. These were the Philistine cities. They didn't conquer all those cities. And unfortunately, because they didn't do that, the Philistines became kind of a real thorn in the side of Israel even centuries later. And Goliath was a descendant of Anakim. Goliath was over 9 feet tall. And they refer to these people as being giants. Well, I've looked up into the Guinness World Record books, and you know, they have people that have been about 8 feet tall that have been in these record books. So I don't think it's far-fetched to believe it at all that these people were of great size and great stature. And they had all these different names. Like I said, if you read the different names that are listed for them, there's the Anakim, there's Anak, there's Rephaim, there's Nephilim, there's the sons of Anak. These are the names that were given to these giants by various people. And to me, the spiritual application is pretty glaring in terms of, you hear the old adage, a rose by any other name is still a rose, well, a giant by any other name is still a giant. And let's say we may be confronted with all kinds of different giants in our spiritual experience in life. In other words, if you have a physical illness, that could be a real giant that you got to deal with in your everyday conflict, living for Christ in this world. If you have, you know, anything can be a giant in terms of mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, financially, any of these type of things can be called by any other different name. These are the things that can come against us and discourage us or defeat us unless we find our strength in Christ to deal with these various things. This is why this is written for our instruction. But you look at what Joshua had to go through here. It says that he fought basically long and hard before the whole land was taken. And if I'm not mistaken, it took them, if you count the time it took them to conquer the land on the east side of Jordan, plus it took them about 5 years to conquer the entire land on the west side of Jordan, it took them about 7 years. So I think this, the suggestion is still pretty strong for us today in terms of this is going to be a long, drawn-out, protracted war, battle. All right? Like I've been a Christian to be 34 years next month. You know, and I've been in thousands of spiritual battles, and a lot of time it does not get easier. It can really be a difficult thing, but you got to just keep trusting God. You just got to keep believing Him. You got to keep walking humbly with Him. You got to keep showing courage and boldness in the face of a lot of people that are just hostile. I mean, just really hostile to Christ and the things of God, and they just make a complete mockery of your stand for Jesus. But hey, in the end, you know, who's really going to be the loser? I mean, you just got to weigh it out and figure, hey, you know, you throw your lot in with Jesus Christ and you can't lose. I mean, you absolutely cannot lose. I mean, sure, you can feel defeated at time and again. You can feel like you're experiencing setbacks or disappointments or heartbreaks or disillusions. But in the end, you're going to win. I mean, there's just no two ways about it, because you're on the right side. You know, you're on the winning side of history or of eternity. Anybody want to add or share to this chapter 11 that we read? Let's just go through this chapter 12. And I do think that even though some of it may seem dry and bland, or some of it seems like useless information to us so many centuries removed, again, I think there's a strong spiritual application that can be drawn from this chapter 12, when it says, "Now these are the kings of the land whom the sons of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed beyond the Jordan towards the sunrise, from the valley of Arnon as far as Mount Hermon, and all the Arabah to the east. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, both the middle of the valley and half Gilead, and even as far as the brook Jabbok, the border of the sons of Ammon, and the Arabah as far as the sea of Chinneroth towards the east, and as far as the sea of Arabah, even the salt sea, towards the Beth Jeshimoth, and on the south, at the foot of the slopes of Pisgah, and the territory of Og, the king of Bashan, one of the remnant of Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth, at the Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Salisca, and all the Bashan, as far as the border of the Geshurites and the Mekarites, and half of Gilead, as far as the border of Sihon, the king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel defeated them, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to the Reubenites and the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh as a possession. Now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan, towards the west, from Baal-Gad to the valley of Lebanon, even as far as Mount Halak, which rises towards Seir, and Joshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to the division." Now, before we get into the various kings that they defeated, he just broke it down just in real broad terms as far as the land that they conquered, you know, on the east side and the west side of the Jordan. And again, there's a lot of spiritual application, I think, that can be drawn from it. I mean, like we are told in Hebrews that God is not unjust so as to forget the love that we show towards His name, administering and continue to minister unto the saints. We are told over and over and over again in Scripture that there are various crowns for the believer. There's a crown of righteousness, there's a martyr's crown, there's a crown for the overcomer, there's a crown for all kinds of different things that we read about in the book of Revelation. And if we put things in a proper perspective and understand that we are in the throes of a real spiritual conflict, well, you know, God takes note of all the territory, basically, that we do conquer in this spiritual battle. In other words, just apply it individually. We have a lot to conquer even within our fallen nature, all right? Because, let's face it, by our fallen nature, our sinful nature is just prone to live in the flesh, and the sins of the flesh, like, you know, you read it in Corinthians, you read it in Galatians, you read it in Colossians, you look at the sins of the flesh, like, for example, anger or malice or resentment or lust or sensuality, impurity or greed or idolatry or sorcery. All of these different things are areas that we really do need to conquer in our own life, and we can only do it by the power of Jesus Christ working through us. And it is not easy. It's a lifelong battle to, you know, die to yourself, pick up your cross daily, follow Jesus, to obey Him, do what He wants to do rather than we want to do. So, but again, all the progress that we make, or any progress that we make, is going to be noted in heaven, and it's going to be duly rewarded. I know it, you know, it's something we don't think about a lot. I mean, I certainly don't. I don't give it a lot of thought at all. I just feel like, hey, you know, to serve Christ, to live for Christ, to obey Christ, if I'm allowed, whatever ministry in serving him, I never think of it in terms of rewards. I always think of it in terms of, hey, this is my honor, this is my privilege, this is my glory, this is what I'm made for. You know what I'm saying? But at the same token, if we do live our lives for God, and we are in the throes of this spiritual conflict, and we are, you know, making every effort that we can to defeat the inroads that the devil's making, it's going to be rewarded. And Jesus makes that abundantly clear. So, and he says here in that verse 8, he says, and in the hill country of the, in the lowlands, in the Arabah, and on the slopes, and in the wilderness, and in the Negev, the Hittite, and Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, and the king of Jericho won, the king of Ai, which is beside Bethel won, the king of Jerusalem won, the king of Hebron won, the king of Jarmuth won, the king of Lachish won, the king of Elgon won, the king of Gezer won, the king of Deber won, the king of Geder won, the king of Hormah won, the king of Ar won, the king of Libna won, the king of Adullam won, the king of Makedia won, the king of Bethel won, the king of Tupua won, the king of Heper won, the king of Aphek won, the king of Lash Sharon won, and the king of Madon won, and the king of Hazor won, the king of Shimron Miron won, the king of Asaph won, the king of Tanash won, the king of Megiddo won, the king of Kadesh won, the king of Jokneam and Carmel won, and the king of Dor and the heights of Dor won, the king of Goim and Gilad won, and the king of Tizrah won, in all 31 kings. Now, he could have generalized the whole thing and said that Joshua conquered 31 different kings and their lands and their territories. But again, look at how he listed here. Like I said, you know, we're so far removed to this, it seems like useless information to us. But what's the spiritual application? What is our teacher trying to tell us? Again, God doesn't overlook anything. Nothing. All right? In terms of the spiritual battle that we're in. And every victory that we obtain in this spiritual warfare is going to be duly noted in heaven. You know, and Jesus himself said, hey, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name to the least of my brethren, it will not lose its reward. So, in the end, what are we told? We're told that there's going to be books that things are written in. All right? There's the book of life, but also there's going to be books that are going to be open as far as judgments are concerned. And on the basis of what's written in these books, our rewards are going to be meted out or punishments are going to be meted out. And I think that that hasn't changed as far as the heart of God is concerned. Anybody have anything want to add or share to what we just read? Yeah.
The name of those areas, I only recognize one name, Bethel. Are they significant? I mean, I'm sure they are. The story attached to all of the names, areas?
Well, here's the thing. A lot of these names over the centuries have been changed. Okay? That's a good question because, you know, some of these names, you're not even going to be able to find it on a map now. All right? Because they've been changed over the years. Some of these you definitely can find. But some of these names have either been changed or been lost in antiquity as far as the cities are concerned because they no longer exist or they didn't exist during the time of Jesus.
And they were completely wiped out.
Yeah,
there's
right.
No story behind the Bethel is with Isaac.
Well, no, that was Jacob.
Jacob filled the rock when he had a dream. Is that the same Bethel?
Yeah, yeah. He actually slept on that rock and then he anointed it with oil. That's why I call it Bethel, because Bethel means house of God. Yeah, that's still around and Jerusalem's still around and Hormah's still around, I think. And you can still find some of these cities, but a number of them you can't even find on a map today. All right? And, you know, that's really what's going to happen in the end. In the end of the world, I mean, let's face it, there are going to be entire nations that are going to be completely annihilated. You know, I personally don't believe that America will be totally annihilated, but I do believe it will be severely chastised. But I believe that Hawaii will no longer exist. And the reason I say that, if you read in the book of Revelation, what does it say? And every island is moved out of its place, and every mountain is brought low. So there are going to be, you know, whole, you know, countries that are going to disappear completely. Yeah.
Another question. It's easier to define spiritual victory. How do you define spiritual defeat?
Well, all you have to do is go to the scriptures, okay? And look for examples. Look at David, all the spiritual victories and even the literal victories that he had in his life. But then look at how he was defeated. He was defeated pretty soundly in some of his experiences. For example, how he sinned with Bathsheba. All right, he just saw the woman bathing and he decided he wanted this woman, so he sent for this woman. He took this woman. He committed adultery with this woman, and then, you know, to cover up this act, all right, when he found out that this woman was pregnant, he brings her husband Uriah back from the front lines of a war to try to get Uriah to sleep with his own wife so that he will think that that's his kid. Well, you know, David really sinned there, because not only did he commit adultery, in the end, he ended up having Uriah killed, and innocent people were killed right along with Uriah, and then he tried to hide his sin, all right? And as a result, his sin was brought out by the prophet Nathan, who told him, you know, that you're going to be, severely punished for this, all right? So, in other words, here is a guy who had so many spiritual, and as well as physical, but so many spiritual victories in his life. But look at how he was defeated. He was a man who followed God with all of his heart, but look at how he was defeated. He really fell. And I believe that the reason he fell so hard is because I think what happened to him is when he basically consolidated so much of his power and won so many of the wars and so many of the victories, he became kind of lax in his prayer life. I really believe that's what happened to him. Even though he was a man who loved God with his whole heart, how was he defeated? I think he was defeated because his prayer life began to wane, because I really believe that if he had been praying, he wouldn't have fallen into temptation. Because remember what Jesus said to the apostles the night before Jesus died? Jesus told his apostles, hey, pray, lest you enter into temptation. And then when Jesus went off to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane and sweating great drops of blood, his apostles just kept sleeping and sleeping. He came back to them again and again. They kept sleeping. And he said, man, you know, this isn't the time to be sleeping. You need to pray. Why? Because you enter into temptation. So what happened? When crunch time came and Judas and the mob showed up, Peter jumps up almost like in a drunken stupor because he was half asleep, and he pulls out his sword and starts, you know, flaying around and chops off Malchus's ear. He was totally in the flesh because why? He wasn't praying. Defeat in our Christian walk is when we fall into sin. But we don't have to be defeated if we do what? If we're praying. If we're always praying, you know, this is what Jesus said. Pray that you may not enter into temptation. There was another time in David's life where he really, really blew it bad. All right, because we're told in Chronicles and we're told in Kings that there came a time in David's life where it says that Satan stood up and he basically enticed David. Put it in his head, why don't you take a census? Take a census of all Israel. And he decided to do that, take a big census of all Israel. What do you think David's motive was for taking a census? To see how many people he was ruling over. You know? Because that was very displeasing to God, because even his godless commander Joab could see, hey, this isn't a good idea. He tried to dissuade David from doing that. He says, hey, don't be doing that. He says, hey, may the Lord bless you 1,000-fold more with people. He says, but don't take a census. And David was absolutely adamant about it. He was insistent about it. So Joab went and took the census, but he left out a few cities as far as the numbers were concerned. And finally, I mean, the way God judged him, you know, he sent a prophet to him and says, hey, man, you've sinned. You've really blown it. He says, you've got three choices. You can either be experience 3 days of pestilence. You can experience 3 months of being defeated before your enemies, or you can experience 3 years of famine. What's it going to be? What happened to him? Well, he was hard-pressed. He didn't know what to do. He said, well, it's better to fall in the hands of God than to fall in the hands of men. So he took 3 days of pestilence. And for 3 days, the angel of the Lord went through all of Israel with a slaying angel went through with a sword. And 70,000 people lost their lives because of his foolishness. And when David saw the angel at the threshing floor of Ornan, and he was begging God to relent of this judgment, and God told the angel, put back your sword in the sheath, and that's where the threshing floor of Ornan was, where David offered sacrifice to God, and that became the place in which they built the temple. All right, but look at how he failed. You know, he took the census. It says that Satan stood up against him. So in other words, that was a tremendous defeat in his life, right? Tremendous defeat. Why? Because I'm convinced the guy became lax in his prayer life. Why? Once the land was secure, once the battles were all won, basically, and had been fought, you know, then he kind of kicked back and took his ease rather than being very zealous. That's what can happen to any of us. If our prayer life begins to wane, if we begin to become lax in our prayer life, man, the devil can get in and raise all kinds of havoc. And he can defeat us left and right. He can defeat us in any number of ways, especially where we're weakest. What's our weakest point? What is it? Is it anger? Is it lust? Is it pride? Is it, whatever it is wherever our weakest point, if we're not praying, that's where the devil can defeat us. I don't know. I hope I answered your question. You know? I will. Anyway.
Yeah, so basically it's not defined as trip or stumble or it's sin that is spiritual defeat, not difficulty in life.
Oh, no, yeah. Don't mix up the two. Don't mix the two. Yeah, we're always going to have difficulty, okay? One way, shape, or form, or another. I mean, this is it. We're living in a broken world with a fallen nature, and we're just going to have troubles. I mean, the Bible does say it. In this world, you will have tribulation. There's no getting around it. That's not the same as defeat, all right? You know, you just got to look at what we read tonight in terms of, in this world, we will have conflict. But when we obey God, follow God, then we will have victory in spite of the conflict.